If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
Sacramento.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creator of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. Coming up, President Trump rallies supporters in Pennsylvania tonight. Can he convince people that he's making America affordable again?
Also, could you make it through 48 hours without using AI? Reporter A.J. Jacobs tried and found it everywhere. For instance, his city tracks water usage.
If I'm taking it really seriously, then I can't drink water. I can't wear clothes made in the last 20 years.
So he wore his grandpa's old clothes. Oh, boy.
And the latest on Netflix and Paramount's competing bids for Warner Brothers and how either deal could change the landscape of Hollywood. Coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S. economy headlines President Trump's visit today to a swing congressional district in Pennsylvania. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, President Trump's holding a campaign-style rally in Mount Pocono at a time when polling data suggests waning trust in his response to affordability concerns ahead of next year's midterms.
In his second term, President Trump has done very little domestic travel aimed at pitching his policies to the American people. In fact, he's done way more travel to sporting events than going out in the country and making his case. A senior White House official I spoke with, who was not authorized to speak publicly, readily acknowledged that this sort of messaging travel has been lacking and said the president would be ramping it up late this year and into next year, starting with today's trip to Pennsylvania, which is to a competitive congressional district.
NPR's Tamara Keith reporting. A United Nations report calls on countries to reform their economies and reduce pollution to prevent premature deaths and poverty. NPR's Jeff Brady reports the sprawling 1,200-page study includes the work of nearly 300 scientists from around the globe.
Every 4 years, the United Nations Environment Program issues its Global Environment Outlook. Executive Director Inger Andersen says addressing human-caused climate change, biodiversity loss, land degradation, pollution, and waste would improve human lives.
Doing so could, by 2050, avoid 9 million pollution-related premature deaths, lift 200 million people out of undernourishment, and move 150 million people out of extreme poverty.
Andersen says that while upfront cost for this level of change would be significant, there would be even greater worldwide economic benefits in coming decades. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Scientists in Britain say they're making progress on a new type of gene therapy to fight a rare and aggressive form of leukemia. It involves editing the DNA of certain white blood cells. Here's NPR's Lauren Freyer.
Scientists behind this new treatment call it the world's first therapy of its type, using advanced gene editing with certain immune cells. It's being tried for patients whose cancer has not responded to standard treatments. The first patient was a 13-year-old girl. She and eight other children, plus two adults, have all undergone treatment as part of an early-stage clinical trial. It was conducted by researchers at University College London and the city's Great Ormond Street Hospital. According to results published in the New England Journal of Medicine, 9 of those 11 patients achieved deep remission that enabled them to go for bone marrow transplants, and 7 of them remained disease-free between 3 months and 3 years after treatment, including that first teenage patient who now wants to be a cancer doctor. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Paul Lancour. Closing arguments are expected to wrap up today in the murder trial of San Francisco filmmaker Kevin Epps. KQED's Sarah Hosseini reports.
On Monday, Epps' defense team tried to chip away at prosecutors' portrayal of Marcus Polk, Epps' ex-brother-in-law, as an affable, if troubled family member who routinely visited to hang out, watch TV, and even help out. Prosecutors told jurors that Epps shot Polk out of irritation during one of these visits at the home of Epps' then-fiancée and their children. But Epps' lawyers argued that Polk was an unwelcome intruder with a meth habit who refused to leave when Epps asked him to. They said Polk threatened to beat up maintenance workers outside and later came at Epps, who shot him in self-defense. I'm Sarah Hosseini, KQED News.
The Trump administration yesterday denied Endangered Species Act protection to Western Coast Chinook salmon in Northern California. Administration officials wrote that, based on the best available scientific evidence after a review, the species does not require additional protection. Environmental groups say the spring-run Chinook salmon are in significant decline. Jeff Miller is with the Center for Biological Diversity.
I mean, this isn't going to just harm these salmon. It's going to harm all the other wildlife that depends on them. Orcas almost preferentially feed on these spring-run Chinook.
Miller says the group is seeking ways to appeal the federal decision and ways California itself can protect the fish. I'm Paul Lancour, KQED News.
Support comes from Oakland, San Francisco Bay Airport. Beauty, pride, love. Learn more at iFlyOAK.com. Support for NPR comes from Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. And the listeners and members of KQED. A late morning mix of cloud, sun, a little bit of fog still remaining, becoming partly to mostly sunny later in the day around the bay, highs in the 50s to the 60s. Looking ahead to tomorrow, Weather Service has issued a beach hazard statement that starts tomorrow morning through Friday evening for high surf and sneaker waves along the coast. Sacramento, still some late morning fog, haze until late afternoon. Look for cloudy skies the rest of today with all the fog. Highs 44 to 52. Chilly tonight, clouds and fog returning. Lows 39 to 45.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young in Boston.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. It's Here and Now. The White House says President Trump will focus on bread-and-butter economic issues tonight when he speaks with voters in Pennsylvania. He'll hold a rally in Mount Pocono, the first stop on a national messaging tour. Pennsylvania is a critical swing state. It's also where grocery prices have risen the most, according to Consumer Reports. Trump campaigned on lowering the cost of living, but nearly a year into his second term, he struggled with how to talk about it.
Affordability is a hoax that was started by Democrats who caused the problem of pricing.
That was last week. Yesterday, he acknowledged it was an issue.
You can call it affordability or anything you want, but the Democrats caused the affordability problem, and we're the ones that are fixing it.
Former congressman from Pennsylvania is on the line with us now, Republican Charlie Dent. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, great to be with you, Peter.
Trump is hitting the road to get a message out across the country on the economy and affordability. What kind of reception do you think he's going to get in Pennsylvania?
Well, it's interesting. The president is going up to northeastern Pennsylvania. That's Scranton-Wilkes-Barre area. He's actually in Monroe County at Mount Pocono, kind of wedged between the Scranton-Wilkes-Barre area and the Lehigh Valley, two critical swing areas for the state. And I think he's going up there for a reason. His support in that part of in that part of the country is eroding. We saw in the recent November election in Luzerne County, where Wilkes-Barre is, the county immediately next to where Monroe and Pocono are, went for the Democrats. And this is a county that Trump won three times by a big margin, and Obama had won it. It was one of those counties that went from Obama to Trump, and it never went back. And so I think he's going up there because he realizes that he is in political trouble in that part of Pennsylvania. So that's the issue. Plus, there are two congressional races in that area. The seat that I used to hold in the Lehigh Valley and the one that in Mount Pocono, those are two of the biggest battleground districts in the country in the upcoming midterm election. And so this issue, these are working class, these are working areas where people are concerned about affordability and they are hurting. And the president's going to have to come up with a message better than what he's had up to this point.
What about that message? A week ago, the president was saying that affordability, the issue, was a hoax concocted by Democrats. Today, he's going into this critical district to talk about bringing prices down. Does he need a more consistent message?
Yeah, he certainly does. You know, calling it a hoax the way he did certainly sounded tone deaf. But people up there, you know, they are worried about things like tariffs. I mean, the president, you know, is acknowledging now belatedly that his tariff policy is raising prices. That's why he is all of a sudden is going to eliminate tariffs on certain products and commodities that are not grown in the U.S. or, you know, coffee, bananas, and things like that. So he's now acknowledging that those tariffs are hurting people. But I think the best thing he could do right now is try to lower those tariffs. But he seems fixated on it. And that's one thing that's within his power that he could do. He's also pushing the Fed, to lower interest rates, which many argue may have an inflationary impact. So the problem for the president is, you know, he's going to talk about lowering prices, but many of his policy actions and rhetoric are moving in the opposite direction. So I'm curious to see what he's actually going to say to lower prices, other than maybe putting price controls on pharmaceutical drugs.
There's a recent report from the Federal Reserve of Philadelphia that shows the middle class is spending less. Hours at warehouse jobs are being cut back. Small businesses are struggling. In some ways, what you're telling me sounds a lot like where President Biden was in 2020, trying to tell people the economy was solid when they didn't feel it in their own lives. I mean, is this something that the party is recognizing, this bind that they're in?
Well, I think the Republican Party certainly understands that they need a better message than the one that the president has put forward. I mean, they saw what's happened in all these special elections. And, of course, most recently, the off-year election in November, when Republicans up and down the ballot were beaten badly and by significant margins. So they know it's not working right now. Whatever it is that's being done, it's just simply not working. And they need to get laser-focused on the economy, on jobs, and especially on prices and inflation. And, of course, there's another major issue Republicans have to contend with right now, and that is these the affordable health care plans, the ACA tax credits, premium tax credits, are about to expire,
right,
which means, you know, many millions of Americans will see a sharp spike in their insurance premiums, their health insurance premiums.
Well,
so that's
Charlie, I have just a minute left. I want to ask you about that. The Senate is supposed to vote on this on Thursday. Are Republicans on board with this, or do you think they're going to push for something else briefly?
Well, it does. Look, the Republican Party in Congress simply does not have a consensus on health care. It never has, and it's not likely to have one before Thursday. So the question becomes, I suspect we'll see a vote on the Democratic health plan, which is to extend the ACA tax credits until two or three years probably. That's the plan. Now, it doesn't sound like the votes are there to pass it. So I suspect you'll see a vote, but you may not see an outcome that resolves the problem.
Charlie Dent, a Republican and a former congressman from Pennsylvania, thank you very much for your time.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, another expense top of mind for families, childcare, extraordinarily expensive and not enough facilities. Recognizing this problem, some states are trying solutions. Just last month, New Mexico became the first state to offer free childcare to families of all income levels. And in Connecticut, childcare is free for families making under $100,000. Imagine if there was only a federal plan with high-quality programs, free for the poor, and a sliding scale for families depending on income. Well, there was one in the early 70s, but it was nixed by President Nixon for political reasons. Princeton historian Julian Zelizer has written a terrific essay on the history of child care in America. It's titled Why Richard Nixon Killed National Child Care. He's with us now. Hey, Julian.
Hi, nice to be with you.
And first, just a reminder, according to the Department of Health and Human Services, child care is considered affordable if it costs no more than 7% of a family's income. Is there anywhere in the U.S. where that standard is met?
Well, there's a few places it's a little cheaper, like South Dakota. But in most cities, and not just big cities, and many rural areas, it's more than that, and there's not enough facilities.
Right,
so it's
right.
True crisis for many American families.
Oh, it's awful. And so you're the historian. Remind us, there were child care programs in the U.S., you know, in the 1900s when women went to war or into defense production.
That's exactly right. During the New Deal, FDR had put into place these emergency nursery schools that were run through the Works Progress Administration for the children of unemployed workers during World War II. We have a much more extensive program where the government invested in true child care facilities. There weren't enough to cover everyone, but we had over 3,000 centers, 130,000 kids were served. And it was a pretty bold program. But in 1946, once the war is over, Congress takes it apart.
Yeah. Well, but then you move forward and you have people like Marion Wright Edelman and the great Shirley Chisholm, you know, campaigning again for care for children. And we get ourselves to the 70s when more women are going back into the workforce. And there was bipartisan support, tremendous support for universal child care like other countries have. Why did Nixon kill the Comprehensive Child Development Act?
Well, you have this big bill. It's over $2 billion. It would have provided money for facilities that met federal standards with all kinds of programs from prenatal care to educational classes for kids. Mm-hmm. Nixon originally supported something like this, but in the winter of 1971, he's getting ready to go to China and open relations with China. So he wants to do something to ease tensions with the right wing of the party.
Right, because they didn't want him to open China.
Right. Yeah. No, they were upset about that, and they were also upset about child care. And so Phyllis Schlafly, for example, the Eagle Forum, is saying this will be a communist takeover, essentially, of the family. And Nixon says he's going to go with that argument, and he vetoes the bill, and he makes this speech that doesn't just say it's too costly, but he says this would essentially be the road to socialism, and the government would raise your family. And so it kills the bill. And that was it. Best chance we had.
Well, and even though, as I said, there was such bipartisan support for this, you know, across the spectrum, but also I'm reading in your essay, the editors of the Washington Post praise that legislation that Nixon killed as being as important a breakthrough for the young as Medicare was for the old. And then you have this conservative movement rising up and Nixon bows to them. You have, you know, people like South Carolina Republican Senator Strom Thurmond saying that Washington would mold the characters of our nation's young. And of course, that would be a problem. And Nixon, you know, jumps in with them. How, I mean, what a moment that was missed. But also, how does that leave us compared to other countries?
Well, we don't do well. We rank, according to the OECD, very poorly compared to other countries. There's countries from Sweden to Germany to Canada and places like France that all have much bigger federal or national investments in child care. So we are a country where access is very limited. The subsidies are primarily through the tax code. And when we talk about affordability for many families, this is front and center.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Phyllis Schlafly, again, founder and head of the Eagle Forum, very against the growing women's movement at the time, against the, you know, something more than the traditional single wage earning American family. She did not want women to go back to work. She didn't mention, as you point out, that she had help for her kids as she, you know, waged her campaigns. Do you think there's any chance now that there could be more support for a universal program? And I only have a few seconds here.
It may be. Look, if it keeps building at the state and city level, maybe it will bubble up as other ideas do to the national level. It's a long haul. The conservative movement is now in power. But as you're seeing, there's a lot of demand for the government to do something. So let's see how the state ideas and the city ideas spread nationally.
A lot of conservative families are struggling as well. Princeton historian Julian Zelizer, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll link you to his terrific essay. You're listening to Here and Now.
In Uganda, a program seeks to address poverty by giving cash and financial coaching to people who need it. Now, funding to global development programs like this are being cut.
If we can find a better way of squeezing more juice out of whatever we're doing, then you can expand and help more people. And instead of going to 1,000 communities, we can go to 2,000 communities.
More on those challenges on All Things Considered from NPR News.
More All Things Considered ahead at 1 this afternoon and an update later in the afternoon at 4:30.
Hi, it's Peter Sagal from NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I'm already drafting my New Year's resolutions. Among them, next year, I'm going to start drafting my resolutions even earlier. And, you know, well, read more books and stuff. But I'm also going to keep asking you to support public radio, because some things I just don't need to change. Thanks.
Visit kqed.org/donate.
Support for KQED comes from Gardens of Golden Gate Park. Lightscape at San Francisco Botanical Garden opens November 21st. Visitors are invited to a luminous blend of art, sound, and nature that transforms the garden after dark. Tickets at gggp.org. Landmark College, commemorating 40 years of educating people who learn differently, with programs on campus and online for both students and professionals. Learn more at landmark.edu.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com.
It's Here and Now. People who live in rural areas in this country are having a harder time finding maternity care. Take Wyoming. In the last 2 years, 4 labor and delivery services have gone out of business in that state, which has created a gap in care, and midwives are stepping in to help. Hannah Merzbach of the Mountain West News Bureau takes us to one birth center in southern Wyoming.
Near an I-80 off-ramp in Evanston, across from a Chevrolet dealership, there's an old white house. Upstairs, it has a tattoo shop.
So we'll have screaming down here and screaming up there.
Because down here, midwife Jana Hartzell delivers babies.
This is the birth room, so they have the option for...
Aside from the inflatable tub for water bursts, the vibrant space looks like a bedroom, with a queen-size bed, purple walls, and yellow curtains.
To make it feel like you're at home when you're having your baby versus, like, cold, sterile hospital feeling.
Midwives specialize in natural births and fewer drugs. They don't have as many years of education as obstetrician gynecologists or OBGYNs, but are trained to handle low-risk clients and transfer them to a hospital if things don't go according to plan.
We take on women who are experiencing normal physiological pregnancy.
The idea for the birth center first came about when the local hospital delivery unit shut down last year. It said it didn't have enough patients and was one of more than 100 rural units to shut down since 2020 amid rising costs.
What are people going to do now? I mean...
Many women in Evanston were forced to drive at least an hour to Utah.
Some people don't have a way of getting down there. Some people...
So Hartzell and another midwife pooled their money and opened the birth center. Others, like Sarah Morey, are doing the same. She co-founded a center in the capital city of Cheyenne a couple years ago, but says there's still some challenges around insurance.
We're basically eating $4,000 to $5,000 per client.
Specifically those on Medicaid, which in Wyoming doesn't cover the fees that go towards birth center facilities and administration. Morey's lobbying to fix this with state lawmakers, many who already see midwifery as a way to fill care gaps. But there are other hurdles.
It's been the hands-on training.
In order to get a degree, midwives need to attend a certain number of births in person. And there's just not enough midwives to teach them.
It's hard to feel confident without finding high-volume centers to apprentice at.
In states like New Mexico, where there's state-sponsored apprenticeship and a long-standing nurse midwife program, which Abby Reese runs at the University of New Mexico.
Community traditions were preserved.
She says midwives were marginalized decades ago by mainstream medicine. But in New Mexico, indigenous and Hispanic communities help keep the practice alive. There, many state lawmakers are on board.
Who will say something along the lines of, my grandmother was a midwife, or I was born at home.
In New Mexico, midwives attended more than a quarter of births in 2021, twice the average of other states in the region. But Reese wants most care to come from midwives, similar to that in some European countries.
With physicians in consultative roles, so that we can leverage that precious workforce.
Some states have a shortage of OBGYNs, including Idaho and Wyoming, where lawmakers have passed abortion bans. Those states are training family care doctors to fill the void and take on more complicated pregnancies. In Arizona, Montana, and Nevada, recently launched nurse midwife university programs. For 19-year-old Rustin Mitchell, midwives are part of the solution. She had her first baby in that Evanston birth room.
There was a point where I was like, oh my God, I can't do this. Somebody give me some drugs.
But she pushed through and afterwards got a home-cooked meal from midwife Jana Hartzell.
Jana cooked me a pulled pork sandwich, gave me a nice glass of orange juice, sliced cheesecake. I was on top of the world.
And she felt at home with her healthy baby boy. For Here and Now, I'm Hannah Mersbach.
We have an update now on a story we brought you yesterday. A new study from the Gates Foundation found the number of children dying before their fifth birthday is projected to rise this year for the first time this century. Researchers say the loss of international funding is a big part of the problem. And today we're going to talk about some of the solutions with Mark Sussman. He's CEO of the Gates Foundation, which is also a supporter of NPR. Mark, welcome.
Thank you.
So for people who didn't hear this story yesterday, just catch us up with the news. The death rate for young kids around the world is starting to trend back up, which is significant because so much progress had been made in recent years. What are you seeing?
Yes, so absolutely. We would argue that the greatest success of the 21st century has actually been the reduction in preventable child mortality. At the start of the millennium, over 10 million kids a year died of fully preventable diseases. Every single year through last year, that number has come down. It's more than halved. Last year's number was 4.6 million preventable deaths. And now a new study that we've helped commission from the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation shows that tragically, this year is almost certain to be the first year this century that number rises by an additional 200,000 deaths a year. So it will go back up to 4.8 million.
And one of the reasons you point out is the lack of international funding. There have been cuts. We know the Trump administration has done this. So have other rich countries. How much of a financial deficit is the international community facing right now?
Yes, the most significant reason for it is absolutely the cuts. And these are cuts. The U.S. has made significant cuts. But as you say, it's not the U.S. alone. We've seen across Europe, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, the Netherlands, a number of countries which have historically been part of the unprecedented coalition we've had of donor countries like those, philanthropies like ourselves, the private sector, which have contributed the core finance, particularly to two institutions, the Gavi Vaccine Alliance, which vaccinates kids worldwide, and the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, which has been the biggest fight against those three diseases. And the funding for both of those this year got cut significantly. They both just had replenishment rounds, which they did not meet their targets, and the cost of that is measured in the lives lost in the years to come.
Well, I want to speak with you specifically about what some of the solutions to this might be, because your position is that a lot can still be done even though funding is dropping. Briefly, what's the strategy before we dig in specifically to some of these diseases?
Yeah, well, the first strategy is to keep the funding alive. That, you know, we project that if you have additional cuts of around 20 to 30%, which is currently what's being projected, that you're risking between 12 and 16 million additional deaths between now and 2045. So that's millions of kids who would be alive who might not be if we don't provide the resources. So first and foremost, these are tiny amounts of money relative to national budgets in the US or the UK or elsewhere. Fully fund the most effective and impactful coalitions and investments, particularly the Gavi Vaccine Alliance and the Global Fund. Secondly, what we can do is we're finding more cost-effective ways to save those kids' lives. For $100 a year per person, we can actually prevent 90% of those preventable childhood deaths by investing in primary health care. We've brought down the cost of critical vaccines. We have pioneering new treatments for maternal child health. And we have a new wave of exciting vaccines and treatments coming on stream, which could absolutely accelerate progress rather than have it in, decrease.
You mentioned that one of the issues, one of the areas hit particularly hard would be the fight against HIV and AIDS. I know there are a few new drugs in development. What's the risk there?
Yes, so in HIV AIDS, where we've seen a halving of child mortality, this was a disease that at the beginning of the century was killing literally millions of people. Those death rates have more than halved because of pioneering support, of which the U.S. has been by far the biggest leader, both with its domestic PEPFAR program and as the largest supporter of the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria. And there we have seen some real setbacks, particularly because of the abruptness of some of the cuts that happened in the first part of this year. But then there are new treatments, for example, like a drug called lenacapavir, which is 99% effective at preventing someone from getting AIDS. If you can get them to, you know, young women, for example, who across the continent of Africa are the cohort who are most susceptible to getting AIDS at the moment, you can stop them getting the disease. And there has, and to give credit to the U.S. in this case, the U.S. has supported, along with the Global Fund, along with the Gates Foundation, a new initiative to try and scale up those drugs in the next year and to actually start producing them at scale and at low cost. But that is a good example of a kind of innovation, and we have other innovations that we think can be do the same thing with an oral pill soon. We have more effective treatments coming on for people who actually get HIV. So the whole point is to be able to have these resources take advantage of these pioneering new innovations, which could fundamentally transform the trajectory of the disease.
I do take your point that there's still a lot that you can do with less funding from governments around the world. But if this financial situation were to persist for many years, what's at stake? And maybe most importantly, who will pick up the slack?
Yeah, well, the short version is no one can pick up the slack right now because the scale of the cuts is in the tens of billions of dollars. In the medium to longer term, it absolutely is the low and middle income countries themselves who want to, who are planning to take responsibility for the health needs of their own population and will put in those resources. Philanthropies like ours can do their bit, and we've made a historic commitment of spending $200 billion over the next 20 years to try and support that. But the truth is, that's only a medium-term solution. In the short term, we really need to have those government resources from the U.S. and others coming back, because otherwise the cost is millions of lives that will be lost.
Mark Sussman, CEO of the Gates Foundation. Thanks so much. It's Here and Now.
Great. Thank you.
Live from NPR News in Boston, I'm Josie Guarino. The Supreme Court is hearing oral arguments today on a Republican-led effort to lift campaign spending caps. The GOP is seeking to overturn federal limits on coordinated spending between parties and candidates. A ruling in the Republicans' favor would allow party groups to pour unlimited sums of money into ads across the country. Democrats are calling on the court to uphold the spending caps as a safeguard against corruption. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is reaffirming his refusal to cede territory to Russia, emphasizing Ukraine's legal and moral stance against giving up land. Russia has insisted on territorial concessions being part of a settlement to end its invasion of Ukraine. Zelensky's comments come as the Ukrainian leader faces growing pressure from the U.S. to accept a framework to end more than 3 years of fighting. Zelensky is in Rome today, where he met with Pope Leo. Following the meeting, Zelensky says he invited the Pope to visit Ukraine, indicating it would be a strong sign of support for the Ukrainian people. U.S. job openings barely budged in October, coming in at 7.7 million, with ongoing uncertainty over the direction of the American economy. The Labor Department reported today that latest number of job vacancies is slightly higher than September's 7.66. This is Here and Now.
Support for KQED comes from Frontline PBS, presenting 2,000 Meters to Andriivka, a documentary about Ukrainian soldiers fighting for every inch of their land in the Russia-Ukraine war. Now streaming on PBS.org and the PBS app. Awards eligible. PG&E sharing emergency planning tips like keeping a go bag ready, mapping out two home evacuation routes, and signing up for outage alerts. Learn more at pge.com/outage alerts. More of that late morning fog and haze heading into the afternoon around parts of the Sacramento Valley today. Not exactly hot. Highs 44 to 52. Sacramento's predicted high today, 45. down to 42 overnight. A little warmer tomorrow, maybe 47. Looking ahead, Weather Service says light rain is possible next week.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and MathWorks, creator of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. And Made In, makers of cookware found in restaurants around the world, offering a carbon steel nonstick griddle for home use, designed for use indoors or outdoors, on a grill or over an open flame. More at madeincookware.com.
It's Here and Now. First responders are often exposed to traumatic events, which puts them at higher risk for mental health struggles. That's what happened to Vinnie Montez. As NPR's Lakshmi Singh reports, the police veteran privately battled depression for years until he found a lifeline on the comedy stage.
Most cops try to leave the job at the office when they're off duty, but Vinnie Montez isn't your average cop. He's a stand-up comic.
Millennial cops are entering the police force.
Here he is doing a live show for the Dry Bar Comedy Special based in Provo, Utah.
There's a DUI report, and it was nothing but emojis. drunk emoji, get to the jail, poop emoji.
Montez is a burly guy. He shares bizarre tales on stage of working for the Boulder County Sheriff's Office in Colorado.
The number one question I get asked when I get off stage is, are you really a cop? Because I've never met a funny cop. And I love the fact that I can take a room and make everybody laugh and feel good. And my favorite comments, hey, I really had a really tough week, especially from somebody in the EMS field. And man, I needed to laugh.
Montez has spent nearly 30 years in law enforcement, most of that time as a deputy. Now he's the public information officer. On the job, Montez has responded to wildfires, shootings, and deadly accidents, and each time he did what other officers had done, moved on to the next crisis. Then, one night in 2008, there was a vehicle accident. There was a teenager, and despite Montez's desperate efforts, the teen died. Montez said he hit a breaking point.
I was going to dinner with my better half and sitting across from her and watching people have dinner and smiling, people I didn't know, but I was angry with them. I was mad. I'm like, why are you so happy? Because I was so miserable inside.
That's not uncommon. Police officers are at higher risk of experiencing mental health issues such as depression and post-traumatic stress disorder, according to a 2024 study. Another survey shows more than a third struggle with anxiety or panic attacks. And experts say even though there's more access to mental health resources today, the stigma around asking for help is still a powerful deterrent. Montez went to therapy, but he was looking for more, and he found comedy. Lawrence Miller, a police psychologist based in Boca Raton, Florida, says what Montez is doing makes perfect sense.
Humor relies on a sense of irony, which means that you're able to see an event from more than one perspective. And if someone has been in a traumatic experience, one of the perspectives they try to get is a way of distancing themselves emotionally from the trauma. And humor allows us to do that.
A lot of Montez's fans are other first responders. He says being on stage talking about some of the darker elements of the job helps them feel less alone. Of course, on stage, Montez rarely passes up a chance to poke fun at anyone who might have annoyed him when he was out on patrol, especially if they're outdoorsy, diehard loyalists of the Subaru.
Any Subaru drivers in here tonight? Shut up, nobody cares.
Montez hopes to keep the jokes and the healing going when he shares the stage with other first responders in the national Heroes Off Duty comedy tour starting in January. Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
I can't wait for that tour. It's Here and Now.
Stay tuned tomorrow morning for Morning Edition.
Hamas says it is willing to lay down its weapons after 2 years of war in Gaza, but under what conditions? NPR spoke with two Hamas officials about that and about the group's decision to attack Israel 2 years ago on October 7th. That story and more on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Part of Morning Edition tomorrow starting at 2 a.m., KQED News and the California Report. Stay informed on Wednesday morning. This week in the Bay Curious newsletter, a mystery from a San Francisco World's Fair in 1915. Who manufactured the gems that bedazzled the fair's Tower of Jewels? Read that story in our Bay Curious newsletter. Support for KQED comes from Visit Modesto, celebrating the season with Mo-Cheer festivities, from fresh Christmas trees at a local farm stand to skating under the lights at Modesto on Ice. Details at GetMoCheer.com. And John Muir Health, offering comprehensive cancer care with a team approach and advanced treatment options at the UCSF John Muir Health Gene and Ken Hoffman Cancer Center in Walnut Creek. I'm Dave Freeman. Thanks for listening. The announcers and technical staff of KQED Radio are affiliated with the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, CWA Local 51. AFL-CIO.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And the Morotra Institute at Boston University, hosting the Is Business Broken podcast, featuring conversations with academics, industry leaders, and politicians. More at ibms.bu.edu.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now. So, can you live without artificial intelligence, AI? Well, before you say, of course I can, AI does not rule my life, you might want to listen closely to this next story. Author and journalist A.J. Jacobs decided to try to banish AI from his life for just 48 hours. How hard could it be? Very. And he knows hard. AJ has gone on such challenges before. He's the living the Bible guy. For a year, he tried to follow every single rule. Love thy neighbor. Do not eat shellfish. Be fruitful and multiply. That one was fun. But then there was do not shave. Do not wear clothes of mixed fibers. Stone adulterers. He skipped that one. Well, now a more modern quest, living without AI, something AJ chronicled in a New York Times article, 48 Hours Without AI. He joins us now. AJ Jacobs, welcome.
Delighted to be here. Thanks, Robin.
How hard was this compared to some of the other things you've done?
This was incredibly hard. I was taken aback by how omnipresent AI is. This article is a bit of a sequel to an article I did where I tried to spend a day not interacting with anything plastic. So no plastic objects, not even touching them. And that was very hard because it's everywhere. It's in our clothes. It's in our food. And my editor said, what if we tried it again, but this time with AI? Because his thought was AI is now as omnipresent as plastic is. It's just hidden in plain sight.
Right.
We don't know it. It insinuates itself everywhere.
It is in our clothes. It is in our food, because you had a scale from 1 to 10 of how much AI was in something. And we know when we do a Google search, what pops up right away is an AI search for information. We know that. But how is it in clothing and food?
Well, yes, I knew it was my Netflix cult documentaries that are recommended to me. That's AI. But part of the challenge was to define AI. What is AI? And a lot of people just think of it as ChatGPT, generative AI. But the experts I talked to said AI is ChatGPT, but it's also machine learning. Any program that evolves and learns, it's almost like a recipe where it changes the ingredients. Oh, people love sugar. I'm going to add more sugar. And that is everywhere. Anything that goes on the supply chain is being sent to you using machine learning to figure out what is the fastest route. The water, when I turned on the tap water, the reservoir system in New York uses AI machine learning to predict where is there going to be the most demand. How can we fix the pipes? If I'm taking it really seriously, which I did, then I can't turn on the water. I can't drink water. I can't wear clothes made in the last 20 years because they are shipped using machine learning and design. A lot of clothing designers use AI to help them design. So it was just, I basically was Amish for 48 hours.
Well,
I was a hermit and Amish.
Well, an oddball, sorry, looking as well, because as you mentioned, so you can't wear your H&M chinos, H&M home of fast fashion. You know, they use machine learning to optimize shipping routes. Its designers have used AI-powered tools. And so you dug out an outfit, and it was your grandfather's from the 1970s.
It was very Austin Powers. It was this bright floral shirt and red and white checkered pants. He was quite the dandy, my grandfather. But this was the only clothing in my closet that had not been touched by AI. And I was actually a little embarrassed to be wearing it. My wife said this was the coolest that I had looked since we got married. And I also had these weird glasses that had sort of an Elton John vibe. They were white because one disturbing part of AI is how prevalent facial recognition is. Whenever you walk down the street, there are a lot of cameras that are capturing your image, and they can be run through facial recognition, or some of them are facial recognition right up front. So there are places that sell anti-facial recognition glasses that will block the infrared light and make it impossible for you to be recognized. So I had on these crazy glasses and my Austin Powers outfit as well.
And so maybe nobody recognized you, but everybody was saying, who's that guy coming down the street with that odd outfit on your son's bike that you had to take out of the building basement? Because, you know, every mode of transportation now has some form of AI in it. This is, of course, in Manhattan. You can't use your phone for any maps. So you bought a paper map, which blew in your face in the wind. And I loved that detail where at one point you're trying to read the map and you tried to expand it.
Right. I had not used a paper map in probably 20 years. So I was trying to zoom in on the map. So I took my thumb and forefinger and tried to expand it. And I said, wait a second. So these products have gotten so deeply embedded in our brains that it is hard to function. You had mentioned I tried to rate things on a scale of 1 to 10, mm-hmm. how AI dependent they are. So a ChatGPT generated email, that's a 10. But say the tree outside my window is a 2. It grew from a seed, but New York Central Park Department uses an AI tree census to figure out the health of the trees. So even in a tree, it's there.
Even in paying for lunch, you went out to lunch, which you knew, okay, you knew there was some AI being used in the restaurant, but you met these people for lunch and you ended up going to pay. You asked if they took gold and you actually brought some gold that your mother gave you from a necklace or something.
That is correct. Exactly. Credit cards use AI to try to figure out fraud. Cash is also made using AI. My mom's a jeweler, so she had some of these tiny gold horses. The restaurant does not accept gold. I violated my oath to not interact with AI hundreds of times throughout the day because it is so embedded in our lives.
Yeah. Industrial farms, huge farms, use it to predict water and fertilizer needs. Everything had been trucked and shipped along AI-optimized routes. You end up at one point going out to forage in Central Park. But I loved the voice recognition part of this because you needed to make a call to eBay. So you thought, you know what, I'm going to call 411 information. Remember that? And you thought, well, I'll get a human. And you kept asking for a human. You never got a human. Even the AI voice pretended to send you a human, but it was another AI voice.
Yeah, it is very difficult now with phone trees to get a human. And I also called eBay customer service, and that was just a labyrinthine adventure being sent from one robot to another. It is probably more efficient for them, but it's also very frustrating for us. And that was one of the big points of the article. I think that AI is neither good nor bad inherently. It can be both. In some cases, it's great. AI is being used to figure out medicines that are curing cancer. And I have no problem with the reservoir making it more efficient to send water to me. But it also has incredibly dangerous, unforeseen consequences, like all of the misinformation that AI is spewing out, the facial recognition technology, which is, I think, an invasion of privacy. The point of the article was how prevalent AI is and how we should be aware of that. And we should also be told when I get an email, I hate the feeling of trying to figure out, was this generated by AI or not? I want some transparency when an image or an email is generated by AI or when I'm being facially recognized, can then decide whether it's a good thing and whether it needs to be regulated.
Well, I will say that you were happy to use it when your wife, Julie, asked you at one point to take out the garbage. And as you write, sadly, I could not because you had to avoid the city sanitation system. They use AI robots to sort trash. But I'm sure people might be wondering, how did you write this article?
Oh, well, that is a very good question. I couldn't use my laptop because it uses AI in all sorts of ways, including the optimizing the battery. I did write it by hand with a good old pencil. I had a solar power generator, so I did have light for a while, but that ran out, so I ended up writing by candlelight. But actually, it was nice. There's something lovely about a flickering candle and writing by hand.
A.J. Jacobs, his attempt to live without coming into contact with any artificial intelligence for just 48 hours. His article in the New York Times, 48 Hours Without AI. A.J., thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. It was a joy.
And we will link you to his article and the picture. You have to see the white glasses and the mismatched Austin Powers outfit he wore. It's Here and Now.
Nuclear power plants that had been retired are coming back into service to meet rising electricity demand for AI. Nuclear plants back from the dead, next time on Here and Now.
Catch this story and more coming up. Second hour of Here and Now starts at noon. Support for KQED comes from the San Francisco Symphony, presenting holiday family films on the big screen as the San Francisco Symphony performs the scores live. Learn more about their holiday programs at sfsymphony.org/holiday. And support for KQED's car donation program today comes from local Kia dealers. Donating a car or truck is easy. We'll arrange to have it picked up, running or not, in most cases. Invest the funds back into our news coverage. You could also be eligible for a year-end tax deduction. Learn more at kqed.org/cars.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from MathWorks, creator of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. And CitySpace Productions, WBUR's creative studio for custom podcasts that tell a brand story to ignite engagement, reach new audiences, or enhance customer connections. WBUR.org/creative studio.
It's Here and Now. The race to buy Warner Brothers Discovery has taken a dramatic turn. Just days after Netflix announced a deal to buy the media giant, Paramount swooped in with an even sweeter offer of its own, an all-cash deal valued at $108 billion. And that offer includes the cable news outlet CNN. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is following the developments. And David, we're glad you're here because a lot has happened. Welcome.
Thanks. So much drama, so many headlines, and that's not even what's being shown on the air.
Yeah, so to that point, help us understand how Paramount just swooped in ahead of Netflix with this offer to buy Warner Brothers.
Well, they're not past the line yet. This was the very sale of Warner Brothers Discovery was occasioned by the fact that Paramount made not one, not two, but three unsolicited offers earlier this year. Warner Brothers Discovery's David Zaslav, its chief executive, said, hey, I've been intending to spin off the cable channels from the streaming assets and the Hollywood studios, the more appealing properties. but I'm just going to put it up on the auction. Paramount was spurned for this Netflix deal that was, reported on Friday and in intervening days. And then Paramount came back and said, fine, we'll give you more. And we're doing it, as you said, just as you said, for the entire company. So it's not an enormous premium, but it is, worth several dollars a share more than what, or a couple dollars a share worth more than what Netflix has been offering. Netflix says it still believes it has a deal and that it will hold. But the question is, will shareholders want something more, or will there be more to extract from each side?
The billionaire Larry Ellison and his son David bought Paramount this summer. If they do end up getting Warner Brothers, they could put a lot of pressure on Netflix, which is already the world's largest streamer. How have the stakes for the streaming industry just changed again with this new offer?
So, there are these two opposing visions of what looks likely to happen, assuming some third option doesn't play out, where either you have Paramount bulking up, supersizing to take on Netflix, and for that matter, Amazon, a company that doesn't require entertainment to make its enormous fortunes as the everything store, and therefore able to put a lot of resources and effort into this. And Disney, which bulked up earlier by acquiring several years ago most of the Murdoch's Fox Entertainment assets in Hollywood. Or you have Netflix saying, we're going to just end the conversation now, and we're going to make sure we're the only people left in the room really to lead this industry by bulking up itself. But Netflix already the world's largest streamer, already America's largest streamer, taking over HBO. And, what Netflix would say, at least publicly, is, hey, we're not just competing with these guys. We're competing with YouTube and every other form of streaming distraction and diversion. And so it's wrong to just lump us in with Hollywood. But that's sure not the way most people looking at this are thinking about it at the moment.
It's worth noting the Ellisons at Paramount have strong ties to President Trump. Some of the names tied to this deal are also President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, including foreign investors. Talk about where the money's coming from and why that matters.
Well, so, Larry Ellison, as you say, the co-founder of Oracle, is a digital titan. His son David was able to take Skydance Media, and earlier this year they took over Paramount with some other investors for this deal. They're saying this is fully backed by the Ellisons' fortunes. Larry Ellison, one of a handful of the richest people walking on this planet. And at the same time, they've taken on, as you say, a ton of outside money. Jared Kushner's investment fund, that president's son-in-law, that's a real question mark for a company that wants to take over CNN, one of five major television news networks or divisions, and that already has, would be going into business with the Ellisons. They already have CBS News in the fold. The Saudi Arabians, sovereign investment fund, Abu Dhabi similar fund, Qataris a similar fund. This would be a major amount of money from the Middle East. In this case, the Saudis, a very controversial regime, and also taking money affiliated with the Chinese state. So although those investors say they would forego any control of the board, that's a real question mark hanging over that in terms of the best interests of the nation and of major news organizations.
Let's talk more about the news organizations. I only have a minute left here, but unlike the Netflix deal, as you said, this one would include CNN. This is a news organization that the Trump orbit has not been shy about how it doesn't like it. What are the journalistic implications here?
They're vast. You've seen CBS already in a short number of months be altered in significant ways to try to appeal more to conservatives and very much appeal more to President Trump in ways that he has cheered. CNN has been a constant source of friction. He attacks CNN pretty much every hour on the hour, the president does. And so you would think that the Ellisons would be likely to change that as well. It has been reported widely that they have made significant promises to Trump to do so. When you think about news organizations holding administrations and power to account, this is the ultimate example of that. So I think that's a real question that looms for those who care about having independent sources of knowledge about what people do and say in their name and with their tax dollars. Yeah.
All right. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thanks very much.
You bet.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from Storyworth. Each week, Storyworth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, Storyworth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at storyworth.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Rae Seehorn, the star of the new series Pluribus. You may know her as the co-star of Better Call Saul, which was both the sequel and prequel to Breaking Bad. Vince Gilligan created both shows. Pluribus has a sci-fi premise, but asks larger questions about happiness, anger, conformity, and resistance. Join us.
Another version of Fresh Air later this evening, 7 p.m. right here on KQED News. Heading up to lunchtime, Julie Depesh is here with details about some traffic incidents, Palo Alto.
You know, Dave, it should be a minor crash here in South 101 before University Avenue. All the activity over on the right shoulder, bit of a backup to Willow Road. Got an entry wreck close by in San Mateo on southbound 101. The on-ramp from Hillsdale Boulevard, dealing with that on the shoulder of the ramp. There's a closure in San Jose, northbound 280. The off-ramp to Lee Bascom shut down for flooding until 4 this afternoon. Julie Depesh for KQ. QED.
Traffic support from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, where a commitment to pure ingredients and sustainable brewing meet a legacy of craft since 1980. Sierra Nevada, taste what matters.